What kind of lessons did you learn while you were doing Full Circle that you've used in your sense?
I would think that's a better question, is what lessons didn't I learn? I don't think I learned many lessons then. I think I was too young and too impetuous. I think I, over the years, have learned that you win the war, not the battle. That you can't get actors to do something they don't believe in. So it's no good me, you know, however powerful you are as a director, even if it's a young actor, you can bully a young actor or instruct a young actor into doing what you want. But if they don't believe it, excuse me, in their heart, they won't do a very good job. So I find that 65% of my work as a director now is planning and is man management, is running the floor in a way that people don't know they're working, don't realize that it's hard work and that they're working long hours. And I try and use a lot of humor. I'm not a big shouter, as I was saying to someone yesterday. I shouted at my wife Saturday and not at my film technician, though I wish I perhaps did it the other way around. I'm 66 this year, so I don't feel I've got much time to waste. So if someone is, I get a bit cross when people don't care. I think that so much work goes into making movies, even bad movies, you know, even really crap films. The thousands of hours of caring and love that's gone into making that film, critics can be very harsh. Now, I know it's their job not to care about the fact that some prop man has spent a month making some small object that hardly appears on the table, but there's not, I don't think sometimes that there is much credit given to the fact that it's that even a bad movie is a lot of skill. I try and always enjoy myself. You know, I like shooting. I like the floor. Some directors don't actually like making films. They like the editing process, and they like the prep process. I actually love turning up on the day and seeing everybody. And I come from a circus family. My father was a musical comic, and they were traveling show people. And I guess he taught me. He died when I was quite young, but he did teach me a little bit about, you know, trying to entertain people. I try and remember. I suppose I work on the adage that you have to give out of, you know, 8 compliments to 2 criticisms, because people tend to remember the criticisms much more than the compliments. So I try to make sure that every member of the crew at some point, at some time, is personally picked out by me as being someone who's, you know, helped. I think it's credit. You know, it's so easy. I mean, this is. Sounds naive, but it doesn't always guarantee you'll make a great movie by any means, but it means that you'll probably make a better movie and you'll certainly enjoy the process. You know, crediting someone, if some small, you know, some junior technician comes up to me when I'm sitting in my chair thinking about what to do next and says, you know, Governor, are you sure that last scene worked quite right? Because I don't think people will understand why she did so and so. To actually say, excuse me, everybody, we're going to do that last scene again because Johnny made a very good point a minute ago. Johnny is really pleased about that, and so he should be, and you should credit them. And I think some of my colleagues may not have the, I don't know what it is. I wouldn't say it's confidence, because I think most directors are not very confident people. I'm certainly not. But I think just the understanding of human nature that you need to say thank you to people. And so I suppose I've learned, I progressively learned, I think, a lot more about that side of making films than I did when I was a young man. It was, I was, I'm sure, more selfish creatively and more about just me, and what I can do and what I'm doing. And actually, filmmaking, you know, in those Oscar speeches when the director says, I'd like to thank, well, he bloody well should, because no, he couldn't do it on his own. And I think you do have to be aware that it's a team effort. You have to be the funnel for everyone's efforts. You can't have 2 funnels on a set. You know, I not all the ideas have to be mine, but every idea has to pass through my brain. Otherwise, you get a film that doesn't have any focus. I do feel strongly about that. But no, I'm a great stealer of other people's ideas.
How was Full Circle received when it was released? I mean, I know it won a couple of awards, but after that, what was...
Yeah, not very well, I don't think. Not really. I got reviews somewhere. I think it was I think it was mediocre. We have no advertising budget, so I don't think it was really promoted. No, I would say mediocre at best, really, probably. I can't say that it was great.
Looking at your filmography, I mean, it's just incredible what films you've done and then what actors you've worked with. I mean, it's just, you know, some great stuff.
I've been very lucky. Yeah, they've been great. I do all the wrong things. I kind of, well, what you're meant to do is, I guess, if you want to make a career out of this business, is you're meant to make one film that's very successful and then keep making the same movie with a slightly different title. And that's the way to have a career. Well, first of all, I've never made a movie that was successful enough to base that premise on. But even if I had, I probably wouldn't, because I think the great joy of making films is that you can cheat. It's a bit of a cheat on life, because not only can you start off for a year. I got a phone call last night. I hope I'm making a film with Morgan Freeman next, or I'm doing a, I've written a film set in India, which I'm hoping to do this Christmas. So, you know, two exciting projects, both in worlds. One set in New York is about an old couple. One is set in the ship-breaking yards of India with only one white actor. The rest are all local Hindi and you know, Hindu and Muslim actors from the area. So the learning curve I'll have to go through, the new things I'll have to understand, just the politics of working in India, or the it's so exciting to be able to learn. Most people, you know, who are not as lucky as I am, start their working lives, and if they're good, they work their way up through the whatever the banking system or the publishing system. Every time the phone rings and I say yes, I get a chance to start as a young man again, effectively, and learn a new career and learn a new thing. So it's a very privileged job, directing movies. It takes its toll on you. And I don't take on projects now anymore just, you know, to feed the kids, because luckily all the kids feed themselves now. They're all grown up. But I've never a moment goes by when the phone rings and I read a script and I don't get excited again about it. So I'm very privileged.
Yeah, it's funny that you said that you might work over in India. You're the third person I've either talked to or heard about that's made the move to India for film production for at least one movie.
It's certainly a place that I've been traveling to India for 30 years and cycled through it and gone down the Ganges by canoe and a few other strange things. And it's a tough country, but it's visually, I mean, it's truly a feast for the eyes and the ears. And even the galette, provided you don't eat in the 5-star hotel in Delhi, but you eat on the street, you're much more likely to get food poisoning in the 5-star hotel salad bar than you are on some little street stall, bizarrely enough. So if you don't get, as long as you don't get Delhi belly for too long of your stay, it is like I was never a big LSD escaped me in the 60s. I was too nervous to take mind expanding drugs, but I think India is probably as close to hallucination as you'll find on this planet.
Are you working on one called Blind at the moment?
I'm working on a project called, well, I'd like to do Blind, where we're trying to find the lead actor. It was Clive Owen, who sadly his dates and things didn't work out, as they often don't, and he's doing something else. So we're trying to find the right actor to play that part. So that's a project that I hope will happen. The Indian one is called Salvage. Hopefully we'll be shooting in either this. We have to shoot it in the winter because of the rain and stuff. So it might be this Christmas or next Christmas that we'll do it. That may be my swan song, because I've written and directed. I've written many films. I've worked on them. I'm not a believer in taking credits as a director. I always think it's slightly unseemly when you see, you know, co-written by, music by, co-edited by, you know. As a director, your job is to do a bit of everything. That's what it means. So unless I've really written 60% of a script or something, I don't ever take a credit. But to be honest, I wrote a lot of the Potters, you know, the Dennis Potter stuff I did. Dennis didn't write as much as people might have thought. But I don't take credit for those, whereas the Indian one is entirely out of my mad brain. And I'm not a professional writer, so writing for me is quite hard work, but I enjoy it when I can get it right. And Well, this is a very mad script. It's about the ship breaking yards, you know, where they break ships in India. It's not about that. It's about an old sea captain delivering his cruise ship that he's been on for 25 years to be broken up, and he decides to stay behind and watch his ship be cut into little pieces, and then gets embroiled in the local people and becomes a sort of a thriller in the end. So that will be fun to do, but because it's only got one European actor or one Western actor, and there aren't that many actors who can finance a $10, $15 million movie on their own. There's no female lead, there's no co-star, as it were. So we'll have to keep our fingers crossed, which we are, that we'll get someone. I think we will. But I started designing iPad and iPhone apps about 2 years ago because I got so fed up with waiting for the right script to come through from Hollywood. So that's a world that I'm learning again about, and we seem to be having some measure of success. We had a new app come out last Thursday called London, A City Through Time, which is an enormous history of the city of London, with everything you can imagine, from video to sound recordings to maps, and we're app of the week, or we're editor's choice, and that seems to be taking off. So I'm enjoying again. I'm learning something completely new. So it's good fun. I hope I'll be able to, you know, as I was saying, once you get, I've made three Hollywood movies, or two really. I made a film, the film that probably one of the films I'm most fond of was a film called My One and Only, which I made with Renée Zellweger about 4 years ago, which is a really wonderful film, which sadly we finished in 2008 when the world collapsed financially, and certainly the cinema world did. So we never managed to sell it properly. It got a limited distribution in America and got really wonderful reviews, but never got sold anywhere else in the world virtually. And that was heartbreaking. It took 10 years to raise the money and a lot of work to make. And Miss Zellweger is probably as good as she's ever been in anything, and that's high praise because she's a wonderful actress. So I kind of felt after that I wasn't sure in my 60s whether I wanted to carry on waiting for Hollywood to, you know, I feel that the business has not got more conducive to making the films that I'd want to make. You know, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf probably would not get made today, and it should have done because it's one of the great films of my lifetime. And that, and sort of more and more, though I'll always make a movie if the right script comes along, I decided that I wasn't going to sit on my ass and wait for my agent to say, here's this script you might like, but it's appallingly written, but maybe we can save it.
Yeah, as you were talking about Salvage, I was picturing the exec going, okay, well, this sounds great, but where's the love story?
Well, there is a love story. It's just it's about a Hindu girl and a Muslim girl and a Hindu boy. So it's not mainstream. It will be in English with some Hindi subtitles in certain sections, you know, where they're talking to each other. Where the locals are talking, it won't be in English. It'll be in Hindi. Most of it is in 90% in English, so it shouldn't present a problem with the American market, which really does not like subtitles. I don't blame them. I don't like them either. I'm not very good at reading the words and looking at the pictures. I get a bit confused. That'll happen. But you know, it's been a wonderful career. I wouldn't turn the clock back for 1 minute. If I get a chance to make another one, I should be more than happy.
I wanted to know what it was like working with Ian McKellen on Richard III, because you were talking about how you don't generally take screenwriting credit, but that's one of the few, and both you and he are credited to that.
Yes, I mean, a bit of a cheek, really. Shakespeare did have a little hand to play in it. It was a delight. Ian was, I haven't seen Ian for a couple of years, well, 18 months probably. He'd been off down in New Zealand doing The Hobbit. Ian and I, he's just such a clever man and a wonderful writer. I keep persuading him to try and write movies, you know, not just act, because he is a consummately bright man, extremely well-educated, and has an empathy for human emotions and dialogue that is very rare in either a writer or an actor. So I count him as one of my close friends. Working with him was wonderful. He was so, his humility was remarkable. I mean, if I tell you that I never saw, it was based on a stage production, which I never saw, set in the 1930s that Richard Eyre directed. And so I was sent. I remember driving back from my home in France, and my agent rang me on a cell phone and said, "I've got a, you know, would you be interested in directing Richard III?" And I thought, well, I don't know, you know, I went to a, my parents were, say, were traveling show people, and I was sent to numerous schools. But I went, they ended up sending me to a very expensive British private school, which was a really crap education. I mean, I came away thinking Shakespeare was not for me, and had, was really ignorant as to the majesty of a man's words. So I didn't know anything about Shakespeare, really. I knew all the cliches, but really didn't know the work. And so I read, they sent me the script, I read it, and it wasn't terribly good, to be honest. It was very theatrical still, very Prosarch based. And then I spoke to Ian. I loved the idea of a you know, a horse, my kingdom for a horse, because the rear wheels of your Willis Jeep are stuck in the mud, I thought was a good, you know, an interesting modern analogy. I met Ian and we got on, and he said, well, what do you want to do with it? And I said, well, I wanted to do this and I think we should rewrite it. And so we together started rewriting it. We made a rule that we wouldn't rewrite Shakespeare. We wouldn't, you know, change Shakespeare's text. But we would edit it down, because obviously the full text is about 4.5 hours, and it's almost never, indeed, even in its own period was it put on in full text form. It was always edited down, and it's changed over the years. For example, the version, the famous version by Olivier, he changes the famous scene in the mortuary. It's to not being between Lady Anne and her second, I think in the script, in the original Shakespeare, it's her second cousin twice removed, or something quite ridiculous. So we changed that to her husband, but we never changed any dialogue. We the only thing we changed, I think, was we gave people names. So, for example, Prime Minister, whoever, I can't remember who he plays it now, it was Jim Broadbent, but whatever the name of the character is, Foster, I think it is actually effectively the Prime Minister. So when he is introduced to somebody, the Queen, and he's introduced as Prime Minister, she says to him. So the audience had some idea of what the contemporary correlation would be to that person. Otherwise, you, for an ordinary audience, and I consider myself to be the pleb, you know, just an ordinary person who hadn't studied Shakespeare, indeed I hadn't. So working with Ian was great. I basically looked after the imagery, and Ian looked after the text cut down. So the opening sequence of the tank coming through the wall and the teletext and the setting up was, I suppose, down to me. And then Ian's skills were wonderful at editing down the text to the salient narrative drive that it needed. I would work with Ian tomorrow if the right project came up, and hopefully that would be the same. It was a traumatic shoot, and they often are. We went bankrupt halfway through. The completion bond came in, closed the picture down. We all put our fees up. So I think I was meant to be paid £50,000 to direct it. Ian was getting £50,000. So were the two producers. We all put our £50,000 fee in and managed to buy the completion bond off so that they didn't close the picture. And we kept going. They did love the movie, so they wanted to keep it going. They weren't aggressive in any way. And we finished the movie, and it made absolutely no money and got some wonderful reviews. So long answer to your short question. Ian McKellen is one of my favourite actors, and you know, I think. Have you seen a film called At Pupil that he made? No, wonderful movie. Again, a film Brian Singer directed. I think it was Singer. One of the best films one of the best films you'll see, about a Nazi war criminal that's hiding in central Midwest America, and a young teenage boy realizes that he is one of the guards from Dachau. And says, if you don't tell me about what happened, I will shop you to the police. And it's about how he's corrupted by the knowledge of the torture. It's just a remarkable piece of performance. I'd recommend it to anyone as a piece of acting, filmmaking. Great, great, great time.
The rumor is that you were the guy who created the Newton's Cradle desk toy kind of thing.
Yeah, that's not a rumor. That's true. I started life as a kinetic artist, not a very good one, but in the 60s. I went to art school to. I wanted to be an actor. My dad wouldn't let me, so it was a shitty job. I got into Bristol Old Vic to become a set designer. I was a year too young to start becoming a set designer. They sent me to art school to learn to draw. I got more interested in the art world, which was about environments and happenings and installations, I think they're called these days, whatever, they like to be. And I used to use 8mm film. I used to make giant toys, really. And I used to pay my way through college by... It was the period when the Scottish Gorbals, which is an area of slums in Glasgow, were being pulled down. And there was a tradition in the world of drink in the Victorian era, probably in America too, of producing the most beautiful mirrors that were illuminated pub mirrors with the names of the brewer behind the glass. And these were being smashed up by the thousand every day. And I found out about this, drove to Scotland in a van with an old friend, and we started ripping these things, stealing them basically from these derelict buildings, and then bringing them down to London and selling them on Portobello Road. And then when we ran out of those, I started making fake ones, or imitation ones, I'd like to call them. And then I started making toys from my sculptures. When I was in America on holiday one year in the Smithsonian, I saw a demonstration of Newton's third law of motion, which is what the Newton's cradle or ball race, I think we called it, demonstrates. Every action has an equal opposite reaction. And I made this thing, and I know we sold about 18 million of them, and made quite a lot of money. So, and then I had a toy company for years doing all that sort of British rubbish, and we had a shop in Carnaby Street for several years, and quite a big operation. But yes, I'm afraid there is another actor called Simon Preble who claimed he invented it. I think we both saw it at the same time. All I do know is that it was a much uglier one than the one we produced. We based ours on the Marcel Breuer coffee table from the Bauhaus table, which was basically a continuous chrome steel loop. So it was a very beautiful piece of object. And it's still used today. You see a bad sitcom where you've got an executive at his desk, and you'll see one sitting on the desk there. So, in fact, I live on Portobello Road. I'm now sitting 100 yards from it. And if I walk down there now, I can be sure that I would find on one of the stalls one of the objects I made with my name on the bottom. And when I say, I made that, they look at me like, who is this old fool?
Well, I'm looking at one right now on my desk across the room. So,
oh, are you? Afraid that was me.
Oh, my God, Becky, look at her butt. It's so big. I like big butts, and I cannot lie. You other brothers can't deny that when a girl walks in with an itty-bitty waist and a round thing in your face, you get sprung. What a pull-up tough, 'cause you notice that butt was stuffed deep in the jeans she was wearing. I'm hooked, and I can't stop staring. Yo, baby, I want to get with ya and take your picture. My homeboys tried to warn me, but that butt you got makes me so horny. So, fellas, yeah, fellas, yeah, has your girlfriend got the butt? Hell yeah. Tell them to shake it. Shake it. Shake that healthy butt. Baby got back. I don't know what any of that means whatsoever.